How's it going, everybody? Welcome to Sound Off 106 here on SEScoops.com. It is Sunday, April 4th, 2010, a bright and beautiful day here in New York City, 74 degrees at last count. I did get out for a little bit before, and now I'm stuck indoors doing the Sound Off, but that's okay, because this will be the final Sound Off here before I leave on my journey to South America later this week. I am headed to Costa Rica for a week, so there will not be an original episode next weekend, although I'll talk about that at the end of the show. A lot of ground to cover here in this podcast, and we'll get to WrestleMania, we'll get to Raw, we'll get to, you know, the horrible Impact rating, Jim Ross, a whole bunch of different things, of course your feedback, but I want to start off with some sad news. Of course, I'm sure by now you've heard, I mentioned it on my Twitter page, and it's pretty much common knowledge now that former WWE and WCW star Chris Kanyon, as he was known, or Chris Kloustaris, I believe is his real name, also known as Mortis, during his time in WCW, was found dead, I believe it was Friday night, of an apparent suicide, although that's not confirmed right now, but it's being investigated as a suicide. He was 40 years old. Apparently, it was fairly common knowledge to those that knew him and close friends that he had been suffering from depression for quite some time. He had teased suicide before, and I think it's one of those things where you have people who say they're going to do something and they don't do it, and then people start to doubt it when they hear the same thing over and over again. And unfortunately, he followed through on those threats. Now, we don't know that for a fact. I'm just saying it certainly appears that is what happened. We'll find out, I'm sure, in the weeks ahead. We'll know for sure exactly what happened, but it doesn't really matter what happened. He's no longer with us. He was a pretty talented guy as a performer, and I always knew that he was looked at fondly as a performer, because I recall when WCW in its later years had, I don't remember what they called it. It was they used this sort of match in the Ready to Rumble movie. It was like three cages, one on top of the other. You had to climb to the very top. I believe the first time WCW did a match like that, Kanyon was the one who took this really ridiculous bump, which was safe. He landed essentially on a crash pad, but still, it was crazy. He took this bump where he basically fell off, did a flip, and fell right through the ramp. I remember at the time it was very impressive, and people were talking about it. And, you know, they don't trust just anybody to do stunt bumps like that. Kanyon was one of those guys. He was a very good in-ring performer. Probably never got his just due. I felt that he was just starting to get over in the WWE when he came over during the invasion angle. Of course, he had his catchphrase, "Who better than Kanyon?" And I thought he was really starting to get over, and then he just didn't go anywhere. And eventually, the company just released him, and I think it was a few years after that when he came out of the closet and revealed that he was gay. And, you know, in a business, even in 2010, or I guess back when he made that announcement, it was a couple of years back, but even in today's day and age, you have an industry like wrestling, or really any sport, you know, it's hard. I mean, you have guys that have come out and made proclamations like that and talk about how difficult it was to keep it a secret because, you know, you have a lot of these macho men in these industries, and it's not the sort of thing that you want to just come right out and say. So I know he carried that around with him for quite some time, although I think most people, especially friends and acquaintances of his, really didn't care. You know, if they were a friend of his, they were a friend of his no matter what. He did propose, as I recall, he tried to kind of get himself over and get himself back into WWE a couple of years ago. He had this idea for a gimmick where he would come in and be a gay wrestler, and it just never went anywhere. And, you know, especially today, in today's very PG environment that WWE is in, a character like that just wouldn't fly. Then again, you watch TNA and you see what they're doing with Orlando Jordan, which, you know, I don't think that character is going to last very long, but we'll see. But in any event, a sad story all around, and, you know, one of those situations where in the future when people want to pick apart the wrestling industry, and we've seen it recently with Linda McMahon's senatorial adversary right now in the state of Connecticut, Rob Simmons. He actually put together this video a couple of weeks back, which I thought was kind of tacky. I'm not saying that, you know, young wrestler deaths are not an issue that people should be aware of, but her opponent in the Senate race here put together a video up on YouTube, a campaign video, which is really all it is. I mean, this guy doesn't give two shits about pro wrestlers, but he's doing everything in his power to make Linda McMahon look like a horrible person and put this video together of all these dead wrestlers, Mr. Perfect and Rick Rude. And I think if I remember, there were even some people lumped in there who shouldn't have been because, you know, you've had wrestlers like Earthquake and people like that over the years who passed away from cancer. There's no proof whatsoever that they died because of the pro wrestling lifestyle. But unfortunately, I think Kanyon's name, even if he died by his own hand, is just another name that people like that are going to add to their lists of young dead pro wrestlers in the future. And to me, that's a shame. Speaking of a shame, although of a completely different kind, Christopher Daniels apparently, or so I read this earlier today, was in fact released by TNA this past Wednesday. He appeared, I believe it was on the Ring of Honor Big Bang pay-per-view that they had yesterday. I could be wrong about that. But in any event, he made an appearance at a Ring of Honor event this weekend, challenged somebody, and people were all up in arms. They didn't know if perhaps this was a sign of a bigger talent agreement between TNA and Ring of Honor like they've had in the past, and in fact, it is not, at least not a much bigger talent agreement than they already have. Daniels is gone from TNA, and the first thing he did was contact Ring of Honor immediately and came back to the promotion where he made his name many years ago. Now, I don't understand the rationale behind this. Maybe there was a good reason for it. Let us not forget many, many months back that Daniels, as great of a performer as he may be, was doing some pretty stupid stuff. Him and Hurricane Helms, who were friends, were having some sort of drinking contest. And, you know, you want to have a drinking contest, that's fine. But they were posting about it on Twitter, posting photos. And then, you know, I think what happened was Daniels got pulled over for DUI or something. And that's not cool. And he wasn't fired at the time. I don't know if there was an incident, perhaps, that led to it that TNA's justified in their rationale to get rid of him. I have not heard of any sort of arrest or incident, and so I am led to believe that TNA just decided that we don't have anything for this guy. And if that's the case, that's a big loss for TNA. You know, Daniels will find his footing somewhere. Obviously, he's founded in Ring of Honor. Could he go to WWE one day? Never say never. I don't see him being in WWE at any point. I look at him the way I look at AJ Styles. I mean, AJ is a guy who has specifically turned down WWE before. He wants the freedom to do his own thing and wrestle his own style, and that's cool. I respect that. He is a hell of a performer, even though a lot of people think he's a lot younger than he is. He's actually in his late 30s, but a hell of a hand. And to think that just a couple of months ago, he was wrestling in their pay-per-view main event for the TNA World title. He had a big fan following in TNA, even though they never really referred to him or let him run with that nickname of Fallen Angel. The fans would chant Fallen Angel, and they would chant, you know, best moonsault ever, which is one of his more popular moves. He was over. And then, of course, the Hogan and the Bischoff regime moved on in, and we saw people like the Nasty Boys, and we saw people like Val Venus, who were, ironically, both are now gone from TNA, but Hogan and Bischoff are still running roughshod. There's a lot of big names that they've paid good money for, and Spike has paid money for to bring in Rob Van Dam, Jeff Hardy, to an already loaded roster that includes Hulk Hogan, Ric Flair, Sting, Kurt Angle, AJ Styles, Desmond Wolfe, The Pope, Jeff Jarrett, Mick Foley, and Kevin Nash, you know, The Band. So, you know, Samoa Joe. Look at Samoa Joe. Another very talented performer who could and should be wrestling for world titles. And he was supposedly kidnapped, disappeared from television for weeks on end, and then just randomly, magically reappeared on TV about a week ago with very little fanfare. I think, you know, Joe did some sort of promo and it went back to the announcers and Taz, who of course is supposedly a very good friend of Joe's and he was his mentor on TV at one point, had a very brief comment about, you know, oh, Joe's back. And then Mike Tenay's response was something to the effect of, well, moving on now. I mean, so apparently it wasn't a very big deal that one of your top stars and former champions was kidnapped and disappeared for weeks on end. Nobody really gave enough of a shit, apparently, to at least call the police. I don't know. It's typical Russo booking. It's just impossible to make sense of. Joe is lucky enough to have his job for now. Wouldn't surprise me if this rate of TNA were to give him the pink slip, too. I almost hope they do, because it's obvious to me that TNA's not going to do anything with him. And I think Joe would be better off going back to Ring of Honor or going to WWE. And I could see Joe in WWE one day. Some people might say Solomonster. How do you see Joe in WWE and not Daniels? Joe doesn't fit the typical, the prototype that a WWE wrestler normally falls into. Well, that's true. But Vince McMahon has an eye for talent. And the people that are in that company that work with Vince have to know that Joe is a talented performer that could make them money. And I think if Joe became available and wanted to at least hear them out, I could see Joe in WWE one day. Remember, Joe came up at the same time that John Cena did. In fact, Joe and Cena are friends. I think they came up in the same class at UPW out in California many years back. So there's that connection too. And don't tell me that people listening to this podcast right now would not love to see Samoa Joe putting John Cena up for that muscle buster and dropping him on his head. So anyway, that's the story with Daniels. He is gone from TNA. He is in Ring of Honor. It's a big loss for TNA, in my opinion. But it's not something I'm entirely shocked by, because look at who they're pushing on TV. I mean, it's just, it's obvious. And what they're doing is apparently not working. Now, I know I'm kind of skipping around here a little bit, but since I'm on the subject, I may as well get to it before I get to my WrestleMania thoughts here. And, you know, everybody knew or had to know, TNA I'm sure must have known, that they were not going to perform all that well in the ratings last Monday, because they were up against a live edition of Raw coming the night after WrestleMania. But I don't know that people expected TNA to do quite this badly. Raw pulled a 3.7 Nielsen rating on Monday night, which actually in itself was a bit of a disappointment, because typically the night after WrestleMania, Raw does a little bit better than that. And they were billing Shawn Michaels' retirement speech. I know that when they did the Ric Flair deal on Raw the night after when he retired 2 years ago, that Raw popped, I think, a 3.9. And I think the Flair segment did something close to a 5. And the Flair thing was made out to be a much bigger deal. You had all these people that came out, these legends from the past. Flair has had a longer career than Shawn Michaels. So it was a bigger deal at the time. Raw did a 3.7 on Monday. I think the Michaels segment did a 4.1. I love that segment, personally. Anybody who tuned into the live show that I did with Noah, we did a live edition of SE Scoops Live on the website on Monday night immediately following Raw and Impact. And I said that there's going to be a lot of people who email me, who come out of the woodwork, who are probably going to be disappointed with how the Shawn Michaels segment came off, because they didn't make it as much of a big deal as they did for Ric Flair. They didn't have Marty Jannetty come out and all these people come out. And I kind of cut them off at the pass. I said, look, if people feel that it wasn't made out to be as big of a deal as the Flair thing, they're justified, because it was not. I personally loved the hell out of that Shawn Michaels segment on Monday because it felt real, and it was. Shawn didn't go out there with bullet points. He didn't go out there with a script. He may not have even known that Triple H was going to come out, you know, at the end of the show. And he just went out there. He poured his heart and soul out to all of us. And I still to this day, it's somewhat awe-inspiring for me to listen to Shawn Michaels speak, because it's so different from the Shawn Michaels who would have spoken 12 years ago. It really is the tale of two careers. I think I made a comment a week or two ago on the show about Shawn Michaels' career. It's kind of like Shawn Michaels BC, and then the second half of his career is Shawn Michaels AD. It's like two different people. Still the same talented performer. In some ways, Michaels did his better work in his later years. Michaels never had WrestleMania matches the likes of which he had with Undertaker the last 2 years. So it really is quite impressive what Michaels was able to do. I thought him thanking Bret Hart and the things he said was so cool. I really did. I thought it was just phenomenal television. And obviously, he was being very emotional. And it was interesting because when the fans started chanting "one more match," Michaels was very quick to politely cut them off and say, look, and I think he even said this, if you go back and listen, he said, I'll have to think about it. And I think he threw that little comment in there because he knows in this business, you truly can never say never. But he went on to say, I'm going to do everything in my power to make sure that one more match does not happen. He wants to stay true to his word to the fans. He wants to stay true to his word to The Undertaker. And you got to respect that. Michaels has said that he has been trying to retire for the last 3 years, at least. And Vince keeps pulling him back in, either offers him more money, he guilt trips him into coming back because a couple of wrestlers get hurt at once and they don't have any stars. And I'm sure WWE will try again, but I think they have to know. I think what Michaels did in that speech last Monday, he made it very, very hard for WWE to bring him back anytime soon. I mean, how could the company now turn around after that speech and try to convince him to come back in 3 or 4 months, let's say? They can't. Maybe in a year, they'll go back to Shawn and say, hey, do you have the itch? I don't think he will. Have we seen Shawn Michaels' last match? Personally, I don't think so. But I felt he was being very sincere in that speech. And I think if Shawn does wrestle again, it's going to be at least 2 years. I don't think in a year you're going to be able to go and convince him to come back. But if Michaels can get, you know, heal up a little bit, you know, his knees are shot. You can't get those young knees back. But if he can heal up a little bit, starts to feel better physically, you know, 2 years go by, you know, WrestleMania's coming up. He's feeling pretty good. They have somebody to match him up with. An old legend or maybe an up-and-coming star, I mean, whatever the case may be, I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility. Even maybe a DX reunion match with Triple H, I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility they could convince him to come back. I felt he was being sincere in what he said on Monday, and I respect that. So that was my thoughts on the Shawn Michaels segment, just to kind of, again, I know I'm kind of skipping around here. Impact had a 6-man tag team cage match main event. It was a taped show, but it was the main event of Kevin Nash, Scott Hall, and Six-Pac against Rob Van Dam, Jeff Hardy, and Eric Young. I did not see this match. I was flipping a little bit, but I ended up missing it because, you know, obviously I cared more about the Shawn Michaels segment than I did that match. From what I understand, it was good for what it was. It wasn't overly great or anything. Again, why they're giving away a cage match on free TV a couple of weeks before their all-cage match pay-per-view beats the hell out of me. I mean, you can very easily, if you want, WWE used to do this all the time during the Attitude Era. And, you know, Russo was writing for them back then, too, and they would give some stuff away on free TV, but they could get away with it. You know why? Because business was hot as hell. TNA does not have that luxury. Their business is not hot as hell. Their ratings are plummeting. And they're giving away this match on TV a couple of weeks before they're going to ask people to pay $40 or whatever it is for the pay-per-view. WWE would do these things where, let's say, there was going to be a Hell in a Cell match. And let's say it was the go-home edition of Raw. I vividly remember this before the King of the Ring in 1998. There was going to be a Hell in a Cell match on that pay-per-view. A little match you might remember, Mankind and The Undertaker. And there was going to be a First Blood match between Kane and Austin, which turned out to in part be a Hell in a Cell match because the cell was lowered in the middle of that match. And I vividly remember the go-home edition of Raw. It was supposed to be a tag team match, Kane and Mankind against Undertaker and Stone Cold Steve Austin. Austin came out, no Undertaker, went to work, beating up Kane and Mankind, Undertaker nowhere to be found. Eventually, of course, Undertaker comes up through the ring. Now, mind you, the cell was lowered, so the Hell in a Cell is on the ground. And Paul Bearer has locked himself in the cell. Undertaker, of course, comes up through the mat, beats the hell out of Paul Bearer. And one thing leads to another, and the final image of that edition of Raw back in 98 was Kane had climbed up on top of the cell, and Stone Cold was like, you're not getting away that easy. He climbs up after Kane, the place is going ape shit, and Austin attacks Kane and is beating the holy hell out of him on top of that Hell in a Cell. The place is going nuts, they go off the air. That's a hard sell for a pay-per-view. They didn't actually give you a Hell in a Cell match, but they whet your appetite. They teased you. They made you want to spend your money on that pay-per-view to see those two matches. They could have done something like that, but instead they just give things away. I mean, look what they're promoting for Impact this Monday night. They're promoting a ladder match between Kurt Angle and Mr. Anderson. A ladder match, mind you, to promote a cage match on pay-per-view. Okay. And in this ladder match, what is hanging above the ring but a key? A key to what, you might ask? A key to the bank vault? I don't know. Apparently, it's a key to the cage at the pay-per-view, and this is apparently a big advantage, because whoever gets the key will be able to open the door. Now, this match at the pay-per-view is escape the cage only. So theoretically, whoever wins this ladder match on Monday night will have that key and will be able to open the door and exit the cage at lockdown. My question is, in the history of cage matches, I cannot remember a time where you did not have the referee simply open the fucking door when you got close enough. The wrestler would come over and would tell the ref open the door, he would open it. Or if the wrestlers came close, the referee would open the door on his own, and whoever climbs out of the cage would win. Why all of a sudden the referee is not allowed to open the door, the wrestler is responsible? I'm just guessing it's budget cuts. Fire a couple of referees, the wrestlers have to do the work on their own. Times are tough in TNA, apparently. So it's just stupid shit like that that irritates me. I guess they think a ladder match is going to mean something in the ratings. I think Impact is in deep, 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 deep trouble. There is a very big NCAA title game this Monday night that is going to do extremely well in the ratings. Even Raw, I think, is going to get hit a little bit hard by this game. I think it'll end up affecting TNA a little bit more. I know, you know, the the public announcement by Spike and TNA is that Impact is being moved to 8 p.m. this Monday night only, and it is, by the way, for those of you who might forget, Impact is 8 to 10 p.m. tomorrow night, not the usual 9 to 11. And they claim that they're doing it because that, you know, of competition from the NCAA. That's a cover excuse. It's bullshit. They're going to get hurt by NCAA no matter what. This is an experiment by Spike TV. Okay, do not believe what you hear. This is an experiment that Spike has initiated. This was not TNA's decision. This was a Spike TV decision. They want to see how Impact performs starting an hour earlier. I cannot for the life of me think of a worse week for them to be doing this experiment. If it's just a one-time experiment, these numbers are going to be skewed by the competition. I would say do it a different week or go 8 to 11 for 2 or 3 weeks and then see where the numbers settle. It's obvious to me that 9 to 11 is not working. And 9 to 11 is not working. I mentioned Raw got a 3.7 last week. I did not mention what Impact got. TNA would probably like me and you to forget what Impact got. Impact got a 0.6, a 0.6 rating on Monday night. The lowest rated Impact, I believe, of all time. Certainly one of the lowest rated Impacts of all time, if not the lowest. Not good. Not good. Especially when you consider the star power that they've loaded up on these shows. Jeff Hardy, Rob Van Dam, Ric Flair. These people are not meaning anything to the ratings. And it shouldn't shock you. It shouldn't shock me. It doesn't shock me. Because you can have all the talent in the world. You could resurrect some of the greatest wrestlers of all time. Andre the Giant can rise from the grave. It would not mean a damn thing because you're still booking the show in the same way you've always booked it. You've got to have a change at the top. I say this all the time. So load up the show with as many stars as you want. Have all the cage matches and all the ladder matches in the world. Have all the blood. Have everybody bleed. Have the women bleed, too. It's that time of month. Do whatever you want. Impact's ratings are not going to go any higher. You'll have an Impact that does a 0.6 like it did last week. Maybe they'll go up the next week to a 0.8, and then they'll just drop back down to a 0.6 again. You know, these people are expecting a 1.5. I mean, if they got a 1.5, for fuck's sake, they'd be doing cartwheels in the street. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. And even if Vince Russo was fired tomorrow, and Paul Heyman, who has no interest in the job, or so he claims, Paul Heyman decided to have a change of heart and signed up to be the lead booker and the writer for TNA, it would still be, at the very least, weeks before we could even begin to investigate whether or not the change is working and the ratings might start to go up, because I think there's been so much damage done here. People have this preconceived notion of what TNA is because it's been the same shit for so many years that it would take at least that long to convince people to watch their show. That's how bad the damage, I think, has been done. So a 0.6 is not a good number. Spike was not very happy with that number. They're going to try this experiment from 8 to 10. And I tell you what, if long term it does not work, they're going to end up back on Thursday nights. I said that was going to be a possibility. You know, and maybe it'll be the best thing in the world for them. Because it's one thing to not pick up any new audience, but when you start losing what little audience you already had, that's the time that you want to start panicking. Now, when I see Dixie Carter go on her Twitter this past week and make a sarcastic comment basically suggesting that it was Shawn Michaels' retirement. That was the reason that Impact did so poorly on Monday, when any idiot who looks at the numbers can tell that that's absolutely not the case. Even if Impact lost some viewers to that one segment at the end of the show, that is not the reason that Impact did a 0.6. And even Raw, like I said, should have done a lot better than they did, considering that it was one of the biggest stars in the promotion's history retiring. The problem, of course, there is that nobody believes wrestler retirements anymore, so I'm sure that's what hurt it. In fact, you could say that Ric Flair might have actually hurt that segment, because by Flair coming back, it just makes it even worse. Again, why should people believe that Shawn is actually retiring? But Dixie apparently honestly believes this. She believes that that's the reason Impact did so poorly on Monday. You know what? The numbers don't lie. If Impact goes up dramatically this week, you know, maybe that had something to do with it. The numbers would suggest otherwise. I think this woman needs to stop twittering, put the phone down for a second, and fix your fucking company. That's what I think she needs to start doing. Just two other quick observations from Raw here on Monday night that I jotted down. One, of course, was Randy Orton's reaction. Was huge. Orton was probably the biggest babyface that night, even more so than John Cena. I really like the way that Orton's character is right now, because I think it has potential to really break out and to mean something business-wise. Like, not to the effect of Steve Austin at his peak, but something similar. My concern is that they're going to push Orton more in the babyface direction instead of letting the character just kind of evolve on its own. You know, Orton comes out now. He's very stoic. His demeanor hasn't changed from the way he was as a heel. He's not coming out smiling, doing weird poses. He has that same robotic movement. He walks very slowly, calculated down to the ring, and the place just goes nuts for it. And I think if they screw around with that formula, they're doing more harm than good. Let the character, let him continue to do exactly what he's doing. Don't start scripting promos for him that John Cena does, because that's a lot good that's done for John Cena. The last thing you want is for Orton to start getting those reactions that Cena gets, where you're trying to push him as a babyface and people just aren't buying it. People buy into Randy Orton right now. I like what I heard. I like what I saw. When he hit those RKOs at the end of the match and got the pinfall, the place went nuts. And believe it or not, a segment that involved John Cena and Randy Orton did not bore me. In fact, I really, really liked it. Obviously, that was because they weren't facing each other. But believe it or not, as I'm watching this match, I thought to myself, I might not actually mind John Cena versus Randy Orton if they build it up over the course of several months. So if things continue on as they are, and Orton runs through a couple of people and eventually earns himself a title shot, you could potentially have a modern-day version of, and I know that this is not the best analogy to use, but a modern-day version of Hogan versus Warrior, for example. And I only use that as an analogy because Hogan and Warrior were the two biggest babyfaces at the time, and it was a big match. Of course, Hogan and Warrior were physically, they were a lot bigger, but it was also fresh because we had never seen that match before. This is not a fresh match. I'm just thinking out loud here that the only way I could ever see a John Cena Randy Orton match again, I think, and not be bored by or put off by how stale it really is if Orton continues to be built up this way, runs through a couple of people, and Cena's still champion, and then we get the big rematch, and they're both babyfaces. That dynamic of a babyface or tweener Randy Orton against John Cena might actually be pretty amusing. So let's just hope they keep doing what they're doing, or not doing, and just let Orton do his thing. The other thing I noticed, I just jotted it down because it was so cool and unexpected for me to see, Batista actually used a Mr. Perfect neck snap in the match, which when I saw him fly over, I think it was Cena, when he executed that move, I was like, wow. It's the last move I would have expected Batista to execute. I hope he didn't tear anything, but I thought that was interesting. So that's the extent of my Raw thoughts. Now, let me just talk a little bit here about WrestleMania. We're half an hour into the show. I have not done a podcast since WrestleMania, and so I have not given my thoughts. I did on the live show on Monday, but I know not all of you were able to participate, although you can download that show. I posted a link to the audio on my Twitter page at twitter.com/Solomonster, so go back and download it if you want to. We had some technical issues, of course. What else is new at the beginning of that show? So skip about 20 minutes in, and things kind of pick up at that point. But I thought WrestleMania overall was a good show. I enjoyed it. Was it the best WrestleMania of all time? No. It had the potential on paper to be, and in that respect, it did not live up to expectations. But I still thought it was a hell of a show. Probably one of the better WrestleManias in a couple of years. The undercard didn't really do much for me. And I think the problem is, most, if not all, of the matches on this show suffered, except the Bret Hart match, suffered from one thing. And that was they were all too short. You know, the Divas match, who cares? It was a waste anyway. Although I did predict, did I not, that Vicky Guerrero was going to get the fall in that match. So, see, I know what I'm talking about sometimes. But the Bret Hart match went on way too long. Every other match, I think, was too short. Punk and Mysterio getting 6 minutes, not enough. Cena Batista, who actually had a hell of a match, could have benefited from another 5 minutes. Michaels Undertaker, who got 24 minutes, which was still less than last year, again, could have, I think, benefited from another 5 or 10 minutes. Then again, maybe that's just me talking because I'm a mark for Shawn Michaels Undertaker matches, and they're so awesome together, and the prospect of this really actually being Shawn's last match, I would have loved to have seen another 10 minutes. But the opening tag match, which we knew was going to be just a throwaway undercard match anyway, going 3 minutes, I mean, what's the point? I know you want to get everybody on the show, but really, what's the point? Money in the Bank, to me, felt fine. It didn't feel rushed. It just was like any other Money in the Bank spot fest. I felt bad for Jack Swagger at the end. He had his homicide moment, although not nearly as bad as homicide, trying to climb out of that cage on that January 4th Impact show. That was just horrendous. And incidentally, you know, probably the main reason why we haven't seen much of Homicide on TNA TV up until the Hernandez injury angle. But, you know, Swagger winning Money in the Bank was interesting to me. And I had people say, oh, Solomonster, you know, a couple weeks ago you said that he was in the doghouse. He was. He was in the doghouse for a while, actually, and nobody could really figure out why. I still don't know why, but he absolutely was. And that's why he was jobbing around the Royal Rumble to Santino Marella on Raw. Okay? There was a reason. And apparently he's out of the doghouse now. I read that in some other wrestling newsletter. There was no explanation. It just, they had mentioned that they heard that he was out of the doghouse and would be getting a bit of a push. To me, this was more than just a bit of a push. Winning Money in the Bank is a big deal because every Money in the Bank winner up to this point has successfully cashed in and become champion. Now, we saw Swagger on Raw the next night try to cash in against Cena. Cena turned the tables. I was just positive that Swagger was tapping out. Thank God he did not. And during the live show in the chat room on Monday night, we had people saying, well, do you think he's going to be doing this all the, you know, every single week? And I said, I don't think so. And I was half right because the very next night, he decided to cash in against Chris Jericho. And sure enough, Jack Swagger is your new World Heavyweight Champion on SmackDown. If I had a guess, I would assume they're going to build to a triple threat match at Extreme Rules with him, Jericho, and Edge. I just can't see them doing Jericho and Swagger in a match that essentially is just two heels, and then what do you do with Edge? So I'm guessing it's going to be a three-way. I hope that Swagger doesn't drop the belt so soon. First of all, these two titles have been hot potatoes now for months. It's time to let the titles sit on their respective champions for a while. Even John Cena. He's a 9-time world champion. And to me, that's a crime when you have a guy like Shawn Michaels who's only been champion 5 times or 4 times. To me, that's a crime. That's seen as a 9-time champion, but seen as a product of the current generation where everybody holds a title at least 3 or 4 times. It doesn't help Swagger to do that. It helps him if you keep the belt on him for a while. And a great example of that that I can give is JBL. When JBL became champion, nobody bought it. I mean, nobody believed that he could even challenge for the world title, let alone hold it. And I was part of that group. JBL as a wrestler never did anything for me. He was boring. On the microphone, he was great. As a character, he was phenomenal. But JBL really grew into that character because he was champion for something like a year or 8 or 9 months or whatever it was before he dropped the belt to John Cena at WrestleMania. So there's something to be said for keeping a guy strong by keeping the belt on him for at least a couple of months. I hope they do that with Swagger, but I don't know. These people have ADD. It's very difficult for them to keep the belt on one person for any extended period of time. The days of Bruno Sammartino and Hulk Hogan holding the belt for 4 years or 8 years, which I wouldn't approve of that anyway, but those days are long over. So a rare world title change on a taped SmackDown. Kind of a big deal. Let's see where they go with it. Back to WrestleMania. My favorite match, it goes without saying, was Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker. Match of the year so far. Will it be topped? I don't know. Was it better than last year? That's what I keep hearing from people. Was it better than last year? It's in some ways, it's unfair to compare it to last year just because the stips were different this year. Last year was more of a straight wrestling match. It was all about the streak. And it was also the first time since Michael's first career, if you want to look at it like that, that he and The Undertaker had a match. How many years on this podcast did I rant and rave about the fact that we never got a Shawn Michaels-Undertaker match? I could not fathom why they were holding off. And I saw. I finally see why. Because it was so much of a bigger deal than if they would have just given us the match 4 or 5 years ago. It meant so much more. If they had given us Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker for the first time back in 2004 or 2005, that match would never have main evented WrestleMania 26. And I think these two WrestleManias were better off because of Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker having a match. You take that match away, I don't think this WrestleMania is all that great, quite frankly. Although Cena Batista as a main event would have done okay because they had a pretty damn good match. But it was no Shawn Michaels Undertaker. You know, the benefit of hindsight, because I did go back and watch that first match. I would probably say the first match was slightly better. I enjoyed it more. But I don't know that means it was actually a better match. I just think seeing those two guys in the ring for the first time in so long, you know, the Undertaker almost killing himself on that dive is a memorable moment from that match. Seeing Michaels kick out of the tombstone was nothing short of shocking. I mean, you had fans with their mouths agape. That camera shot of Undertaker from last year, after Michaels kicked out of the tombstone with his head resting on Michaels' body and this look on his face like, what do I have to do to beat this guy? And on top of that, and this might have been the key ingredient here, what that match had that this match did not was Jim Ross on commentary. And Jim Ross added so much to that Michaels-Undertaker match last year. Just an incredible amount. And also, even though Michael Cole was part of that commentary team, we had the benefit of not having to listen to Matt Stryker, who at one point I thought was a pretty good announcer and I enjoyed it, and I don't know what happened. Actually, I do know what happened. Vince McMahon basically neutered him. He is atrocious. I cannot stand to listen to Matt Stryker on commentary. Everything that comes out of his mouth is bullshit, which is fine to some degree. He makes up everything. He has no credibility whatsoever. And he's also very cliched in the things he says. He is annoying to the max. He has perhaps overtaken Michael Cole as the most annoying announcer. Thankfully, I don't see as much of SmackDown as I do Raw, so I can't say that for sure. So Michael Cole still retains the record in my book as being the most annoying announcer in WWE. But having Michael Cole and Matt Stryker on the same commentary team is enough for me to feel extremely badly for Jerry Lawler. And Lawler has had a very blessed wrestling career and has dated women probably even younger than me. So I can't feel too bad for him, but I actually feel sorry for Lawler. And Lawler, by the way, from what I understand, legitimately, in real life, very much hates working with Matt Stryker. He cannot stand him. And it's obvious why. And I actually thought that he took away from this year's match a little bit. So maybe that's why I look a little more fondly on last year's match. However, having said that, I thought the match this year was phenomenal. Even a Michaels-Undertaker match that slightly falls beneath expectations is still going to be the best match on the show by 5 miles. It was the right match to end the show. I was very happy to see that. I know they like to end the show with a feel-good moment. In some ways, I thought this was a feel-good moment. It was sad to see Michaels' career theoretically come to an end, but it was kind of a storybook ending for a guy who deserves it. I mean, look at his body of work over his career. One of the few guys that was loyal. Now, granted, he did at one point try to negotiate a release from WWF in the late 90s. He wanted to join his friends in WCW, and Vince McMahon wisely said no. Unlike I think it was Brad Siegel in the dying days of WCW, who decided, okay, I'll give a release to you guys when confronted by Eddie Guerrero and Chris Benoit and Dean Malenko and all those guys who just let them go to WWF, which was stupid. But Michael still, he was with the company the whole time. He never went to WCW. He was loyal. Just consistently had the best matches, put his body on the line. And to see his career end in such an excellent match in the main event of WrestleMania in front of 70,000 people, he seemed at peace with himself. He didn't seem sad. He had one or two tears streaming down his face. He was emotional. But to me, as I watched him come up the aisleway, he almost looked more relieved. He remarked to a fan as he was coming up the aisleway that his kids were going to be sick of him within 3 weeks of him being home. He seemed happy. He seemed relieved that it was all over. Because, like I said, he's been trying to retire for a couple of years. If it was up to him, he would have been done a couple of years ago. Thankfully, we got an extra 3 or 4 years out of Shawn Michaels than we would have had he gotten his wish. And selfishly, I wish we had another 5 more, but we don't. Even if he comes back now and then, Michaels, as a full-time performer as we have known him, is done. And I think the Raw brand and WWE in general suffers now because of it. I really hope that they can keep this momentum going that they had in the weeks leading up to WrestleMania. I thought Raw on Monday night was a really good show, but it's only one show. SmackDown, new champion, big things are happening. Let's see what happens in the next couple of weeks. Let's hope they can keep that momentum up. Obviously, they're going to continue some of these programs, Cena Batista, Punk and Mysterio, Edge and Jericho, I guess now it's Swagger, factored into the mix, Triple H and Sheamus, and we'll see beyond that, we'll see where they go. Apparently, the Hart Dynasty now are baby faces. They've been slotted with Show Miz in a feud for the tag belts. I thought what they did on Raw Monday with Bret Hart and all that was really good stuff. Bret himself, for those of you who have been asking, his contract that he signed back in, I guess the contract itself would have been signed in late December, was only meant to run through about a week or so after WrestleMania. So his contract is essentially up. He has agreed to do some appearances. He'll be on the upcoming European tour as a special enforcer for some of the main events. He's going to be doing some autograph signings for the Hart Family DVD that's coming out this week, I believe. Beyond that, that's really all they've agreed to, but Bret has said he is open to doing more. You know, Bret Hart, what did I say on the show last week? Go back and listen. I said this exact thing. Lost in all the hoopla heading into WrestleMania was the fact that we may have been heading into a show where Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels were going to have their final matches. Now, I have no doubt that Bret's last match was it for him. And this may also have been Shawn's last match. And I think there's something that's appropriate about Shawn and Bret retiring on the same show. And even the next night on Raw, they both had, essentially, retirement speeches. Bret said his final goodbyes. Even if he does make a couple more appearances, it was his way of really getting closure and saying, the last 3 months have been phenomenal. I've enjoyed it. Thank you very much. And Shawn, of course, had his retirement speech on the same night. It's somewhat eerie, but I think it's also appropriate because these two men, their careers, their names, have been so interlocked for so many years that it's, I think, appropriate for them to call it quits at the exact same time. And the fact that the two of them, and Bret and Shawn have both done interviews saying the same thing, that they've made peace with one another. You know, they might even go so far as to call each other friends, I think is really cool. If Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels can heal their old wounds and make up and be friends again, then goddammit, we can have peace in the world one day. Because I'll tell you what, this is one thing I never thought I'd see. But I'm happy I did. You know, those images of Bret Hart and Shawn meeting up when Michaels came back through the curtain after WrestleMania and the wrestlers were all giving him a standing ovation and they were hugging him and shaking his hand and he came up to Bret Hart in the hallway or Bret came up to him and they were exchanging some words and they were laughing and smiling. That was a really cool image. And a big contrast to what we saw in Montreal 13 years ago or whatever it was. It's good that we finally were able to put that shit to bed once and for all. Let's hope that we don't have to hear about Montreal or see another promotion recycle the Montreal finish, which WWE has done dozens of times. Yeah, they did it with Punk and Undertaker at the Breaking Point pay-per-view in September. TNA did it, of course, because TNA has to copy everything from WWE, the good and the bad. Let's hope that we are done once and for all with Montreal. We've put it to bed. you know, Brett got his revenge on Vince, and Shawn made up with Brett, and let's just be done with it. Now, back to WrestleMania for a second. Obviously, Shawn Undertaker had the best match of the night. That super jumping tombstone is an image I'll never forget. I'm sure the Undertaker's knees were probably barking the next morning, but goddamn, that was an awesome finish to that match. Unfortunately, the Bret Hart match with Vince McMahon, not so awesome. We knew going in, at least, because I told you on the show that Bret was not wearing his pink tights, so I could see where some people would be upset by that, but it could not have been shocking because we knew this going in. Bret said he wasn't going to wear the pink and black. I at least would have liked to have seen Bret wear the old Bret Hart shades, but I guess it was not to be. Vince McMahon comes out, claims that he has paid off the Hart family, and they all march down to the ring, and everything about this match was ass backwards. Why they would do the reveal before the match begins, where Bret immediately turns around and says, oh, well, I knew that you had paid off my family because they told me, and so you're actually the one who's been screwed. And the whole match was just one giant squash. Vince didn't get any offense in on Bret, which we knew, because Bret can't take any bumps. He had a stroke. He had the concussions. He had the Lloyd's of London policy, which was very particular in what they could and could not do during that match. He couldn't take any shots that even came close to his head. No bumps, no back bumps. So we weren't going to see the old side Russian leg sweep or anything like that. He did drop a couple of elbows on Vince, which was kind of cool. I think the biggest thing that Bret did wrong in this match, and it's just the way the match was booked, Bret, the first time Bret teased the sharpshooter, the place went nuts, because that's what everybody paid their money to see. They wanted to see Bret put Vince in a sharpshooter and not let go. Bret teased it, and then he didn't do it. And then he teased it again, and he didn't do it. And when he finally did it later in the match, I don't think the pop was as big, because people either didn't believe he was going to do it, or they were just tired of seeing him tease it. He put the sharpshooter on, not the best Bret Hart sharpshooter we've ever seen, but he got it on, Vince tapped. I thought this whole thing went way too quick. I think they should have milked it, they should have had Vince, you know, you have Vince tapping right away, that's fine, because Vince McMahon should tap right away, but I don't think Bret should have let go as quickly as he did. I think you had Bruce Hart as the referee, and by the way, Bruce Hart, of all the fucking people to have as the referee for this match, you have Bruce Hart? Are they nuts? Where was Jim Neidhart? He was at the Hall of Fame the night before. I know he was in town. Wouldn't have made more sense to have Jim the Anvil Neidhart as the referee? I mean, I was dying for a heart attack spot that we never got, but, I mean, at least make him the referee. Why Bruce Hart? But Bruce Hart, and again, maybe he went into business for himself, or maybe he was told to do it this way, but he called for the bell practically immediately. I mean, if I'm Bruce Hart, or if I'm the, whoever's in that role, Vince is tapping, I'm getting on my knees and saying, what? What? I can't hear you. I can't hear you, and milking it for at least 10, 15, 20 seconds. I mean, 13 years of pent-up frustration in this storyline, I just thought that the whole ending of the match was just way too quick. The match itself, though, was not quick enough. That match would have benefited by being no more than 3 to 5 minutes long. They gave the opening tag match 3 minutes. I think they should have given that match another 8 minutes and made the Bret match 3 minutes. This match would have been far, far better than it was. The crowd just could not care less. You could hear a pin drop in that stadium. And what was interesting was the chair shots that came later in the match. Vince, first of all, Vince took a heart attack from the Hart Dynasty. Excuse me. Earlier in the match on the outside. Now, Vince is not a trained wrestler. So, obviously, he pretty much deadweighted himself. You know, Davey Boy Smith's son, Harry, tried to lift him up. He's a real strong kid. He could barely get Vince up. He had to put him down, pick him up again. Vince landed right on the back of his head. It was pretty nasty. And again, he's 64 years old. He should not be taking moves like that. Later in the match, when Bret was whacking him with the chair, it's a perfect example of less is more. Now, chair shots to the head are a thing of the past, at least we hope. But I think one very strategically placed chair shot would have meant even more. As opposed to Bret literally wailing away 15 or 18 times on Vince with that chair. It got to the point where it was kind of uncomfortable. Because he was really laying those shots in. He was being stiff. I'm sure he was having a ball. Don't get me wrong. Him and Vince have kind of made up. But believe me, I'm sure Bret enjoyed wailing away on him with that chair. You know, Vince has a bad back. So at one point he was kind of obviously he was in pain. He was contorting his body. He turned onto his side. So then he was taking chair shots to the shoulder. It got to the point where if it were anybody else, I think it would have turned that person babyface. And to me, it didn't make any sense. And then after WrestleMania, I'm reading the Wrestling Observer newsletter. And Dave Meltzer is, he's become really good friends with Bret Hart. So he's been clued in a little bit more than most people on this storyline. and he kind of knows the lay of the land when it comes to this whole thing as it's unfolded. And apparently, the way that match was constructed, I have a hard time believing this, but the way that match was constructed with the chair shots and everything at the end, it was for a very specific reason. And that reason is that Vince McMahon wanted to be turned babyface at the end of that match. And he felt that by doing it the way they did it, he would have turned babyface. Bret could win the match. He could leave. And when Vince left or was carried away, or what have you, at the end, he would be cheered by the crowd and looked at as a babyface. Because Vince McMahon, in his mind, feels that he's done as a performer on camera. The Mr. McMahon character, he wanted this to be the blow-off for the Mr. McMahon character. For good. And it might have been. I still think Vince is, it's going to be very difficult for Vince not to bring back the character in the future on TV. I fully believe, as far as Vince McMahon matches, that this was the last one. I think I said on the last show that I thought Vince McMahon was one of the, if not the most underrated performer in WrestleMania history, because he had three or four WrestleMania matches before this one, and I thought virtually everyone was good to great. And a lot of that may have had to do with who he was in the ring with, but still, Vince McMahon matches typically exceeded expectations. The match with Shane at WrestleMania 17 was phenomenal. The match with Hogan at WrestleMania 19 was better than it had any right to be. The match with Michaels at WrestleMania 22, in my opinion, I know not everybody would agree, one of the best matches on that entire show. It certainly held its own. Vince didn't have a match at WrestleMania 23, although he was involved in the biggest storyline with Trump and had his head shaved, which was a pretty big deal. And that pay-per-view is still to this day the highest grossing, best performing WrestleMania, or I think any wrestling pay-per-view of all time. So Bret Hart and Vince McMahon, you think, wow, this is going to be a hell of a fight. And it really wasn't. Vince just took a beating. It didn't look good. Vince was very, he was very stiff. Even just when he took bumps, he just didn't look good. I think age has caught up with him. I don't think he should be in the ring. Like I said, he's got a bad back. So as an in-ring performer, I fully believe that he's done, and that's fine. But he thought this would be the blow-off to the Mr. McMahon character. That was the way it was booked. Because in his mind, the Mr. McMahon character was spawned by the events of the Montreal Screwjob in 97. It gave birth to that evil Mr. McMahon character. So to him, being beaten up mercilessly by Bret Hart and losing in the sharpshooter at WrestleMania, you've come full circle. The character's done. So that'll be interesting to see, because Vince went into this pay-per-view fully expecting this was going to be it for that character. And he would just continue working backstage and do that and not worry about being an on-air performer anymore. We'll see. We'll see how long that lasts. I have a very good feeling we have not seen the last of Mr. McMahon. And maybe, you know, maybe Vince will be on TV and he'll just be a very straightforward, regular authority figure. And he won't be the over-the-top, you know, egomaniacal Mr. McMahon that we're used to. But that was the plan, apparently, heading into the pay-per-view. What else here? Just some quick final WrestleMania thoughts. The Orton-Rhodes-DiBiase match was, I thought, better than it had any right to be. The crowd was really into Randy Orton, as we saw the next night on Raw. I actually enjoyed it. I thought it was good for what it was. I thought that double DDT spot off the ropes was really well done. Orton won, which I predicted it was the right move to make. So I didn't have a problem with that match at all. Triple H and Sheamus, it didn't really do much for me. It kind of bored me a little bit. Triple H won, which I think was the wrong move. He did make Sheamus look good in this match, but I just think Sheamus would have gained more by actually winning, even if he cheated. A win over Triple H at WrestleMania has been made out to be a big deal. I think Sheamus should have gotten the win. Obviously, the feud is going to continue. I'd have to think that at some point, Sheamus will get a win over Triple H, maybe at Extreme Rules. But I thought it was, you know, for what it was, I thought it was a good match. But nothing overly exciting. And yeah, those are my basic thoughts on WrestleMania 26. Real good show. The show looked awesome in that particular stadium setting. That was a really cool place, I think, to hold a wrestling show. That may have been the biggest entrance set and stage that they've ever used, and it looked every bit as extravagant as they wanted it to be. They had that little video thing that would come down over the ring when people would make their entrances. Just really, really cool stuff. Thumbs up. Michael's Undertaker delivered again, even if it was a notch or two below last year's match. Still a five-star effort, in my opinion, and certainly did not regret spending my $54.95 on this particular pay-per-view. So you know, Jim Ross was at WrestleMania. He blogged about it. He was incessantly asked by people if he would be announcing. He said he would not be, and as it turned out, he did not. Now, I can tell you that the wrestlers were told, you know, as recently as a week before the pay-per-view, that the announced team was going to be Jim Ross, Jerry Lawler, and Michael Cole. Obviously, Vince McMahon changed his mind. It was a call by Vince McMahon and nobody else. It was his decision to make. Apparently, his decision was, if Ross is done as a full-time announcer, because JR has said he can't do that travel schedule anymore, he hoped to work out some deal with WWE where he can do announcing on a limited basis, maybe for just some big shows. Vince McMahon is of the opinion that you're either in it or you're not. And if you're not going to be a full-time announcer and dedicate yourself 100%, then you're not going to get the gig. And so he said it's going to be Michael Cole, Jerry Lawler, and Matt Stryker, and Jim Ross can sit up in the skybox, which is where he was. And Ross did a lot of blogging and tweeting about it, and it was obvious he was not happy. He would have much rather have been there to at least announce the Shawn Michaels Undertaker main event. Michaels and Undertaker, it's worth noting, both went to Vince and pleaded their case, much the way that Steve Austin and The Rock did back in 1999 when they had their WrestleMania 15 main event. Remember, Jim Ross had a bout of Bell's palsy a few months before WrestleMania, and he was off TV. He did the evil JR character with Dr. Death as his bodyguard and all that. He, you know, healing on Michael Cole, which is funny to look back on. And but he was off TV, and Michael Cole and Jerry Lawler were the announced team, and this was 11 years ago. And the main event of WrestleMania that year was Austin versus Rock for the title, and Jim Ross came out before the main event and did commentary for that match, and he was back at that point. So JR had hoped to at least announce that match. Michaels and Undertaker went to Vince and said, look, we want him to announce our match, and Vince said no, and that was that. He's the boss. So I think it was a bad move. I don't like Michael Cole as an announcer. I hate Matt Stryker as an announcer. It's amazing how he's turned me on him so quickly. But again, that may be Vince McMahon's fault. But either way, I think that pay-per-view, I think that main event would have benefited from JR on commentary without question. And the question is, where do we go from here? Ross had signed a contract extension with the company that I believe will expire in a couple of weeks. He hopes within the next few weeks that he will know for sure what his role will be in the future. It may be where he does some stuff for WWE 24/7. WWE is planning to launch their own 24-hour cable network sometime in the year 2011. Perhaps Jim Ross will have some sort of role in that network. But his announcing days, apparently, in WWE are over. It is the end of an era. And I cannot think of a shittier way for his reign as an announcer in this company to come to an end, you know, with such a whimper. It's just, in my opinion, it's just an injustice. I can actually understand Vince McMahon's point of view. I'm not saying Vince is an evil bastard here. I can understand in his brain that if Jim Ross is not committed to being their full-time play-by-play announcer, that he does not deserve to be calling their pay-per-views, that he does not deserve to be calling their big three-hour shows or whatever. Because Michael Cole, for better or worse, is the lead announcer. And how could he ever get better if you take away all of the opportunities for him to perform on such a big stage? You know, Michael Cole has to sink or swim on his own and deserves the opportunity. At least this is, I'm guessing, what Vince McMahon's belief is. And you know what? You and I may not like Michael Cole. Some people like him. I'm sure he's not a bad guy. He's just not a good wrestling announcer. And it's unfortunate because the fans, you and I, are the one that have to suffer for it. But I can understand that rationale. I don't agree with it, though. I just think he's dead wrong on this issue. JR has kind of hinted on his Twitter at the fact that, and his blog, that he might want to perhaps get into announcing in MMA in the future. Maybe not UFC, but that he feels he would be very good. He wouldn't use a lot of the same wrestling terms and mannerisms that he does, you know, that you would ordinarily see him on WWE TV using. JR as an MMA announcer would be very interesting. And I think if that happens, it's a big loss for pro wrestling. You know, I don't see Jim Ross going to TNA. Why would he? TNA can't afford him. If I'm Jim Ross, I look at TNA as a sinking ship at this point. They have not proven to me whatsoever. They have no track record. They have not proven that they can stay afloat, that they can increase their ratings, that they have any intention of changing their product for the better. So why would he ever even consider going to TNA? He wouldn't. If I'm Jim Ross, I don't even consider it. So it's going to be interesting to see where he ends up. Greatest announcer in the history of the business, treated almost as an afterthought in the building at WrestleMania and not used on the broadcast. Just unbelievable. Finally found out the rules to NXT. It only took him, what, 6 weeks or so to tell us. The basic gist of it is that I believe starting next week there'll be one wrestler eliminated each week. They have the pros poll where the wrestlers vote on who they think is the best performer. I have a feeling that this voting is completely legit because apparently Daniel Bryan was voted number one, and yet Daniel Bryan is, I think, the only wrestler on the NXT roster who has yet to win a match. What that tells me is that the wrestlers know that he is light years ahead of everybody else on this show. My guess is that Daniel Bryan wins it all. And at the end, apparently the winner will be able to challenge for any championship belt in all of WWE that they so desire, including a world title. However, I would guess, and it would make sense, which means WWE will change their minds to swerve us all, but Daniel Bryan wins and decides to challenge The Miz for the United States Championship. And that would be fine. Now, what makes this different than, let's say, any other Money in the Bank winner challenging for a secondary belt and making them look stupid? Well, I'll tell you what makes it different. Daniel Bryan has been bullied and badgered by The Miz from the very beginning of NXT. He would love nothing more than to embarrass The Miz, to take his title from him, and to make him look like an idiot. He also recognizes the fact that he is a quote-unquote rookie, even though we all know he isn't. But on the show, on TV, he is. And he probably understands that challenging, let's say, John Cena for the championship is a futile effort. He might have a much better time trying to take the belt from Jack Swagger, but we all know Cena is Superman, and Daniel Bryan will certainly not be taking the world championship away from him. So why not try out for a title that he knows he can win, and at the same time get some sweet revenge on the guy that he hates, that being The Miz, by taking the United States title away from him. So I have a feeling that's where they're going. I hope that's where they're going. I think Daniel Bryan can get over huge in the process. Of course, I guess if he won that belt, he would end up on the Raw brand. And I'm not, as much as I'd love to see him on my TV every week, especially now that we don't have Shawn Michaels on TV, I don't know that Raw would be the best place for him. But it's all a moot point anyway because the brand draft is coming up, I believe, on April 26th, and the rosters are going to change. And so we'll see where things settle after the draft at the end of the month. So let's break into the mailbag here. Got a lot of feedback. I won't be able to get to everybody, unfortunately, so I'll get to as many as I can. Worth noting that I did get some, I actually got a lot of emails from people who pointed out the whole Money in the Bank trend, which I'm sure some of you are aware of. I actually didn't even think of this until people started pointing it out to me. So I thank you to everybody who wrote in with this. And I looked into it, and it's completely accurate. What's interesting is that Edge has been involved in some way, shape, or form in every single Money in the Bank situation, every Money in the Bank title change. Of course, Edge himself won the briefcase at WrestleMania 21 in the very first Money in the Bank ladder match, and then he beat John Cena the following January, cashing in, I believe that was during the New Year's Revolution pay-per-view, to win his first world championship. Now, at WrestleMania 22, Rob Van Dam won the briefcase. He went on to beat John Cena at One Night Stand in June, where, ironically, it was Edge who interfered in that match with a helmet on his head before he revealed who it was, took out John Cena, and helped RVD win the belt. Mr. Kennedy won Money in the Bank at WrestleMania 23. Then he got hurt, thought that he would need surgery on his arm, so they decided to take the briefcase off of him. He lost a very quick match on Raw to Edge, who then cashed in and beat The Undertaker to win the championship on SmackDown. CM Punk won the Money in the Bank briefcase at WrestleMania 24, and then he beat Edge for the belt. Punk won again at WrestleMania 25, and at the Extreme Rules, I believe it was Extreme Rules pay-per-view, or whatever. They used to have multiple pay-per-views in the month of June. Maybe it was the Bash, but Punk beat Jeff Hardy for the championship after a match that Edge had with Jeff Hardy. Actually, I'm pretty sure it was that ladder match that Edge and Hardy had at Extreme Rules. So again, Edge is involved in that scenario as well. And of course, this past Friday night on SmackDown, Jack Swagger beat Chris Jericho after he ran down to the ring and he actually walloped Edge in the back of the head with the briefcase and knocked him out. And of course, if I had to take a guess, I'm going to guess that Edge will likely be involved in challenging Swagger for the title. So I don't think that it was done on purpose, but it's very interesting to see how Edge has factored in some way, shape, or form into every single Money in the Bank title change. Now, that may change now that they're going to have a Money in the Bank pay-per-view in July. But maybe he'll be involved in that match, too. I guess we'll just have to wait and see. But again, thank you to everybody who pointed that out. It's one of those, kind of like the Royal Rumble pattern of the runners-up always being involved in a title match. Just one of those things that's interesting to figure out. All right, let's get right into it here. Mr. 5150, if that is your real name, writes in with a quick question regarding Goldberg. Who would I like to see face Goldberg in WWE? Mr. 5150 here would love to see Randy Orton, Chris Jericho, or Edge, as long as they give the superstars some free will. Well, I wouldn't count on that happening. I don't want to see any of those guys face Goldberg, because with Goldberg, you know what you're going to get. And Goldberg is not going to exactly give a lot to his opponent. So having said that, and hoping that he doesn't make somebody, for example, like Randy Orton look bad, I would love to see Goldberg in there with John Cena, just so Goldberg can spear the shit out of him. Although a battle of the spears with Edge and Goldberg would be interesting, but I think there's money in a Goldberg-Cena match. I really do. I want to give a shout-out to Wilford here while I have an opportunity. I think I might have I read his letter on the air about a week or two ago, his WrestleMania memories. He was the he's a graphic designer for Carlos Colon's WWC promotion down in Puerto Rico, who actually was invited to WrestleMania. He was going to meet with Johnny Ace and some of the people backstage, and he did. Apparently it went very well, and he may have a meeting with WWE, if he hasn't already, within the next couple of weeks about possibly working with them. So good luck with that. He sent over some photos that he had taken during his WrestleMania experience, and including the WrestleMania after party. I don't know that I can share these images, but I just wanted to thank him on the air for sending them over. Really cool stuff, especially Dancing with Maurice. I am insanely jealous. Photos of him with Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels and Randy Orton, everybody all dressed up. Actually, Shawn Michaels wasn't really dressed up. He was wearing a skull cap, but the WrestleMania after party, really good stuff. And like I said, good luck in your meeting with WWE. I know you'll let me know how things turn out with that. This comes from Trevor in England. Dear Solomonster, I believe a few shows back you were complaining about John Cena being poor at selling punches and never really making the other wrestler look good, which I totally agree with. However, I want to know, who do you think is the best and worst at making other wrestlers look good? For example, I think although he isn't the best wrestler ever, Jeff Hardy has a real knack for looking really beat up and even makes his body go realistically limp and beat up looking. This really helps put the other guy over. Well, I got news for you. I don't know how much of that is selling and how much of that is real because Jeff Hardy, you know, he'll be better off, I think, for at least the time being with that limited schedule in TNA. But Jeff Hardy was and probably still is very beat up physically. He probably doesn't have to do very much to make himself look like he's in pain all the time. Same thing with Undertaker. He's pretty beat up, too. He's always selling the knee. You know, there's a even WrestleMania, there's a reason for that. They probably build it into his match, I'm guessing, where early on they go after his knee or he pretends like he hurts his knee so that he can hobble around because he really does walk around like that backstage. So at least in the context of a match, if Undertaker's hobbling around on a bum knee, it only looks like he's selling when in reality he probably would be hobbling either way. As far as looking good, making people look good, I can't think of too many people, unfortunately, from the current WWE roster. I think back to The Rock. The Rock always made his opponents look like a million bucks, even sometimes to the point of absurdity. You know, he would take a stunner, he would take a spear from Goldberg, and he would oversell it. But still, he made the guy look like $1 million, and The Rock could get away with that because he was so goddamn entertaining. Sorry for saying goddamn on Easter Sunday, my God. what else? Who else was I thinking of here? I had another name in my head. Oh, Bret Hart. Right. Bret Hart, when he was in the ring and wrestling all those fantastic matches in his prime, Bret would do these things that would make me feel like, God, this guy's going to fall apart any minute. He would take those chest-first bumps into the, you know, his sternum would go right into the top turnbuckle. Bret Hart could take a pounding and make it look 110% real. He always looked like he was beat up. He was always playing the underdog, and then he would fight his way back. And that was selling. You know, that was pure selling on his part. That's how good Bret Hart was. I can't think of too many examples of people from the current roster. If you gave me some time, I might be able to. But I certainly would not put Triple H on that list. Actually, Shawn Michaels, who just retired, was probably the best at that on the roster. And unfortunately, now he's gone. Lee from Manchester, England writes in my opinion, Bret vs. Vince at WrestleMania was worse than Goldberg vs. Lesnar. Well, I'd probably agree with you on that. As bad as Goldberg-Lesnar was, the best part about that match was the reaction from the crowd, which made it infinitely entertaining, so you're probably right. At least they had a reaction from the crowd. All right, we got a letter here from Matt, writing in, talking about Shawn Michaels and his impressive resume. Obviously, over the course of his career, he had a lot of great matches. Let's see, he's talking about Steve Austin and Shawn Michaels here. Both men have captured me on many occasions, and WrestleMania 14 was just a special moment. Shawn had a 4-year layoff while Austin made the WWF in the Attitude Era. It's the dawning of a sad day. Thinking about these two men and their last matches, what a way for the two biggest stars of the 90s to go out. Austin vs. Rock at WrestleMania 19, HBK vs. Taker at WrestleMania 26. Well, I would agree. Austin vs. Rock at WrestleMania 19 was actually my least favorite of the three WrestleMania matches they had. But it was still a fun match. I remember when Rock put the vest on and got stunnered. That was kind of funny. And it was shocking to see The Rock basically get a clean pinfall win over Steve Austin. But Austin, you could tell in that match, and maybe this is why I didn't enjoy it as much, he was hurting. Austin was not in the best of shape physically. And he knew it, and he knew going in that this was going to be his last match. And you're right, what a way to go out against your greatest rival and one of the other biggest stars in the business at a WrestleMania show in front of, I believe that year it was something like 54,000 people in Seattle. You know, if I'm Steve Austin, he says it all the time. He feels he has a couple of more matches left in his body, but why bother? You know, why come back? What purpose does it serve? He's feeling good. He's got a lot going on with the movies that he's doing and some other gigs. And why, you know, you had your last match at a WrestleMania against The Rock. You know, why blow that off? Shawn, Undertaker, if this is Shawn's last match, I can't think of a better opponent. I can't think of a better match. And I can't think of a better setting. Shawn will never have a chance to be in a main event of WrestleMania again. If this is his final match, I think it is appropriate for him. So I agree. I mean, just think, back in 2003, okay? Later that year, when the year that Austin retired, it might have been 03 or 04, it was one of those 2 years, but just think that Vince McMahon wanted Steve Austin to come back at the pay-per-view, it was one of those Cyber Sunday interactive shows in October, to wrestle Jonathan Coachman and Job to the coach. This is real. Vince McMahon wanted Austin to come back, have a match with the coach. Of course, he'd get screwed, and he would lose to the coach. And you may recall that I think the week before the pay-per-view, Vince McMahon had to come out on TV and claim that Austin called him and said that he hurt himself moving furniture, which is a shoot. Austin called the company and said he couldn't wrestle on the pay-per-view that Sunday because he got hurt moving furniture, which only Austin knows for sure, but I'm willing to bet that was bullshit. And I can't blame Steve. Could you imagine if he came back, had a match with the coach, lost, left the company, and that was the final image of Steve Austin in a WWE ring? Dear Solomonster, what did you think of the reaction that Owen Hart got when his name was mentioned on Raw Monday night? I thought it was great. That, I can't believe I forgot to mention that earlier. That was one of my favorite moments from the show on Monday night. You know, 11 years, almost 11 years now after he died at that pay-per-view, to think that Owen Hart, and you got to imagine that most of the people in that crowd are younger kids and people who were not wrestling fans then and have very little idea, if any idea, who Owen Hart is or was. And when his name got mentioned, the place went crazy. Bret had a pause, so, you know, he could soak up the cheers. He happened to be wearing a t-shirt that had him putting Owen in a kind of a friendly headlock, and when he opened up his jacket to show the shirt to the camera, the place went nuts. And Owen got a huge reaction. He got one of the biggest pops of the show, in fact. And I just thought that was so cool. I still get choked up when I think about what happened, because I had the chance to meet Owen Hart less than a year before he died. I had a really good experience with him. He was really cool to me and my friends. And at the time, I was doing an internship for a local newspaper. When he died, I wrote a very personal editorial column about him and included the photo of me and him. I don't know where that article is. It's not archived anywhere on the internet or anything like that, but I have a copy of it somewhere. Just, I will always cherish that. And anytime Owen is mentioned, I smile a little bit. And when he gets a reaction like that, I just giggle like a little kid because I just think it's so cool. Dion writes in with a couple of questions. What are my thoughts on the commentary for the NXT match on Tuesday that had Chris Jericho announcing with Michael Cole and Josh Matthews? I thought it was great. I actually didn't see it live. Heard about how great Jericho's commentary was, so I found it on YouTube. And Jericho, if he wanted to, and I know he probably doesn't, but when he's done wrestling, if he wanted to do some announcing, he would be phenomenal. In fact, I said the same thing about Big Show a couple weeks back when he did guest commentary. So why not reunite Chris Jericho and Big Show, get rid of Jerry Lawler and Michael Cole, and just have Jericho and Big Show do commentary on one of the shows? I would love that. That would be phenomenal. The other part of Dion's email here, he says, Salamonster, I recently attended a Ring of Honor event in, I'm trying to pronounce this word here. Let's see here. Mississauga, Ontario. I hope I pronounced that right. Just outside Toronto where I live. I had the pleasure to sit ringside for the show and in the main event with Kenny Omega against Davey Richards. Had Richards literally land in my lap after a ring apron attack from Omega. This was shortly before Omega did a springboard dive to the outside. The audience, by that time, people and the chairs had been scattered to make room for them. Question, have you ever been, quote-unquote, part of the action in attending a live wrestling event? Well, I have, and I think I think it predated me doing this podcast by a couple of months. I started this podcast in November of 2007, and this would have been my very first Ring of Honor show, which was at the New Yorker Hotel in New York, in June of 2007. And the main event, ironically, was the man now known as Daniel Bryan in a triple threat match with, I believe it was Kenta, who's a big Japanese star, and Samoa Joe. And I was in one of the first few rows that night, and Bryan Danielson is known, or at least in Ring of Honor he was known, for doing these dives where, a springboard dive, where there would be a guy on the outside, or a guy had been thrown outside and was knocked over the barricade, and he was somewhere in the first few rows of the crowd. So Danielson would get in the ring and would grab the top rope, kind of like Punk does sometimes, although when CM Punk does it, he's doing it from the outside in. But he would propel himself up onto the top rope and just fly out of the ring and into the crowd and onto his opponent. So he did one of those signature Danielson dives that night, and I think onto Joe, if I recall, and they landed right at my feet. And a couple of people got knocked over. The chairs got knocked over. It was really dangerous if you weren't paying attention, but it was cool as hell. And the second time, anyway, Daniel Bryan almost killed me that night. And I believe it was the following year, I was at a Ring of Honor show at the Hammerstein Ballroom, or maybe it was the Grand Ballroom. There's two different venues within what is known as the Manhattan Center. And actually, a little trivia fact, for those of you not from New York who don't know, the first year or two of Monday Night Raw, of course, emanated from the Manhattan Center in New York City, and it was specifically in the Grand Ballroom, which is up on the eighth floor. The Hammerstein Ballroom is bigger, and that's on the first floor. That's where the one-night stand and a lot of the final ECW, the real ECW pay-per-views took place. So just to differentiate between the two venues, but that's all part of the Manhattan Center. Anyway, at the Manhattan Center, there was a match. I don't remember who Nigel McGuinness, better known now as Desmond Wolfe. I don't remember who he was facing. I just know that it was a similar dive that somebody did. Maybe it was Danielson. I don't remember, but they landed on top of me, whereas the first time it was at my feet. This time they actually fell on me, and Nigel was out cold. He was laying on the floor. There was, like, dirty wrappers and popcorn on the floor all around him, and I did what any person in that situation would think to do. I whipped out my cell phone and took a picture. So that's one of my more fond memories of nearly being demolished by a wrestler at ringside. But it is quite fun, I will admit, as long as nobody gets hurt. And, well, of course, when somebody gets hurt, it's not fun. But good times at those old Ring of Honor shows. I actually haven't been to a Ring of Honor show in a while. I'll have to make my way back there one of these days, especially now that the Fallen Angel is back on the ROH roster. Dear Solomonster, what are your thoughts on the Orlando Jordan bisexual angle, oh boy, in TNA? I'm all for doing things different. I'm all for thinking outside the box. And I know that with Vince Russo, you're always getting something where they're trying to push the envelope. That's just the nature of who these people are and how they think. Now, from what I understand, when the angle was over, most people backstage at TNA did not think very much of it, except two people who were very happy and impressed with how it came off. Do you know who those two people are? Essentially, it's the only two people that really matter, Vince Russo and Eric Bischoff. So we are likely to get more of this. I don't see this angle being long-term. I just don't think, you know, they tried this once before with Orlando Jordan, and Spike TV, it was a taped show, and when Spike saw the edit of what they had done, they had the whole segment just edited to bits, or maybe they cut the whole segment altogether. So this is the second time now that they're trying a similar angle with this guy. And I would have to think that at some point, Spike TV is just going to say, yeah, this is not happening. I mean, you've got a TV show, a wrestling show, on a network geared towards men. And this is the character that you think is going to appeal to those men? I mean, in one respect, it's kind of like the Goldust character when it first debuted. There were kind of homoerotic overtones to the character that made people very uncomfortable. I remember that first big feud with him and Razor Ramon, and he would rub his hands all over Razor's body, and you know, the whole thing was he wasn't really gay, he was just playing mind games. And in some ways it was kind of ingenious. When that Goldust character premiered in 95, that character was really the definition of pushing the envelope in pro wrestling. And I was actually, looking back on it, I think it was great what they were able to do. And how Dustin Rhodes was able to kind of break out on his own with his own character. This is a little bit different. Times have changed. There isn't much left, you know, in the way of shock value with this sort of thing that really could do the company any good. This is a company that's on the skids. Their ratings are going down. People do not give a shit, by and large, about TNA. And this is the character that you think is going to appeal to those people? I mean, what do they expect to gain? I'm trying to think how they think this character can make money, is what I'm trying to think. And all that's happened so far is it's caused trouble. Because apparently, after the taping that night, and that show was taped, you know, in advance, a lot of the TNA wrestlers were at a bar in Orlando, and I don't know if it was the white guy in the segment, who I think might actually be Orlando Jordan's real-life boyfriend, I don't know, I don't care, but it might have been him. He was at the bar with Orlando Jordan. I think he was doing some sort of weird dance or something that offended Ric Flair. Now, I'm not going to say that Ric Flair hates gay people. I will say that Ric Flair took great offense to what was going on. He took great offense to what he was seeing. He was extremely angry, and he went over to the guy and essentially cut a promo on him in front of everybody and scared the shit out of this poor guy who then left the bar. Not a good way to start your tenure in TNA. Apparently, Rick took umbrage supposedly with the fact that, you know, who does this guy think he is? He's not a real wrestler, and here he is making an ass out of himself, blah, blah, blah. I, for one, would have loved to have been in the bar that night to watch Ric Flair cut a promo on this guy, just for entertainment value. Not a good situation to be in. My guess is this character is not going to be around that long. They didn't even let him speak on that first show. It was just quite literally an introduction. There was nothing more to it than that. I have to see where they go with the character before I make a real determination as to whether or not it's a good character or not. That's all I'm going to say about it right now. I will reserve judgment until the future. But just judging by that Ric Flair incident and the reaction of most people, except Bischoff and Russo, behind the scenes in TNA, not good. A seer in India writes in, have you seen the new TNA steel cage? What do you have to say about its look? Does it look better than the Six Sides of Steel or the WWE cage? I know, Salamaster, that you hated the look of the Steel Asylum on January 4th, as it was difficult to see inside the ring clearly, and the red color made it look so low grade. What are your thoughts? I think it's fine. You know, I'm still and forever will be a fan of the old school blue bar, you know, squared WWF steel cages. I know why they don't use them anymore. First of all, they make a lot of noise because they're a little loose. But more so because the wrestlers back then were starting to complain vehemently about them because they really hurt. I mean, I certainly would not want to be thrown into those things, and people were complaining, and, you know, those cages are a lot easier to climb. There's more foot room in each of those little squares. And maybe it's just because I grew up on it, you know, mid-80s, watching Hulk Hogan matches, people climb out of the cage, and, you know, a guy like Hulk Hogan would not be able to climb out of a cage if it was just a mesh fence. And I think that was a big part of why WWF created those cages in the first place, because, you know, before that, in the 70s and the early 80s, they used to use the cages that they use today. And then in the mid-80s, they decided to start using the blue bar cages. And I think the last time we probably saw that cage, I'm guessing, was in 1999. They did use it for Austin versus McMahon at St. Valentine's Day Massacre, again, because it was just easier for Vince to climb. But later that year, a match that I would rather forget, the Kennel from Hell with Al Snow and the Big Boss Man, which was essentially a steel cage inside of a Hell in a Cell. And, of course, in between the two cages on the floor, you had these rabid dogs who were supposed to be really mean and vicious and waiting for you when you climbed down, and instead they couldn't corral the dogs all together to do what they wanted them to do, and the dogs basically all huddled in one corner and peed on the floor. That was the last time I remember seeing the blue bar cage used on WWF TV, so, you know, not my favorite cage. It's fine. It's definitely an improvement over what we saw on January 4th, that's for sure. Andrew writes in with an interesting question here. This might be opening a Pandora's box, but WWE is trying so badly to be kid-friendly. Why don't they, instead of putting all their superstars on Nickelodeon and Disney shows, why don't they bring Nickelodeon or Disney stars on Raw to guest host? Why not? They could certainly do that. I think it would make sense. I don't know that most people would want to see, for example, Hannah Montana hosting Raw. Or those two kids from The Suite Life. Can't even believe that I know that show, but I do. I think it's Zach and Cody, right? Zach and Cody from The Suite Life. And the only reason I know this, I swear, the only reason I know this is because when I wake up early on a Saturday or a Sunday, it's one or the other, I'm having breakfast, and there's not much on TV, unfortunately, on Saturday mornings if you're not into cartoons. And I'll just leave the TV on the first, you know, live action, so to speak, show that I can find. And that's usually one of them. It's either that or That's So Raven. There's really either that or a good infomercial I'll watch. But, yeah, why not? Why not take one of those people? Raven Simone. She was at WrestleMania about 2 years ago, I think, and raved about it. She was there because she was doing some charity work and WWE was involved, so she made an appearance. Having somebody like that host Raw would make sense if they're going full throttle on the kid-friendly stuff. I personally think that the Raw guest host thing is played out. I think I mentioned I saw Hot Tub Time Machine, and I thought it was a really funny movie. I didn't think that Rob Corddry and Zach Duke were all that funny on Raw Monday Night. In fact, it just seemed like they were an afterthought. And, again, it's just proof positive to me. Monday was a great example. That guest host concept is dead. It's done. You can get some big stars. You know, and The Rock, I'm sure, is, you know, he's already said that he's willing to do it. It's just a matter of his schedule. But you don't have to do it every week. Do it once a month. Do it every now and then when you can actually corral a big star to do it. It just is completely pointless. You know you're going to get the requisite comedy segment with the Bella Twins. What a couple of whores those two girls are. I mean, every guest host, every male guest host that they have, they butter up to them like nobody's business. On this PG show, you have these two women who are so clearly whores. I mean, they could not make it any more obvious. So I just don't see the purpose of doing the concept anymore. But hell, why not? why not have Miley Cyrus on Raw next week? That certainly would, it certainly would incite a reaction from the fan base. There's no doubt about that. I've got an email here from John. I was going to respond to it in private, but I figured, let me mention it on the show here, because it's good advice for anybody listening who either currently or at some point might want to do their own little wrestling radio show or podcast, and it's just good advice to have. Dear Solomonster, I, along with my friend James, recently started up a wrestling radio show called Wrestling Excess Radio. We both listen to and very much enjoy your podcast, and we're wondering if you had any advice for us as to how to become successful with our show. Not really sure how to word that any other way. However, maybe some pointers or something if you get the chance to respond. I would greatly appreciate it for some advice on our show, which after the past week seems to be on early life support. Well, the best advice I can give you is just be yourself. Don't you know, take other people's opinions and pretend that they're your own. You know, when I give my opinion on something, it's what I really believe. You know, if my opinion falls in line with, you know, another wrestling reporter, and I'm not a wrestling reporter. I've never claimed to be. This is a podcast. This is not an official newscast. There's a very big difference. It's like having a blog. You know, a blog is not a news site. You might report news there and give your opinion on it, but you're not actually breaking the news or anything like that. And with a podcast, I think it's kind of similar. This is not a news show in the traditional sense. This is the Solomonster Sounds Off. This is not SE Scoop Sound Off. I could take the sound off anywhere I want to, and it would still be mine. It would be my opinion. And, you know, be yourself. Don't be stiff. Have fun with it. It's okay to stammer over your words. I mean, God knows I do it all the time. You know, when you're doing a show on the fly, shit like that happens. If people listen to the show and they honestly believe that you believe what you're saying and you're having fun doing it, then that's all that matters. You know, building an audience is not an easy thing to do. You know, my audience is not the size of, you know, a show that you would find on WWE.com or anything like that, but I've been able to grow my audience over the last couple of years to levels that I'm happy with. And we're always bringing new fans into the Sound Off. I get emails from people all the time from literally all around the world. Canada, Mexico, Africa, Asia, Europe, places all over the world. India, the UK, France, Russia, Germany, Belgium, Bolivia. I mean, all these different places. And it's just amazing. It's humbling for me to know that there's people listening to my thoughts and my opinions on this show every single week. I can't tell you how many emails I get that say, oh, you know, I couldn't go a week without your podcast. And it makes me think to myself, wow, you know, the next time I think I'm going to skip a week, I might have to think twice about that. Which is ironic that I say that now, considering that there won't be a show this upcoming weekend. But, again, be yourself. Have fun with it. Don't read from a script. Don't worry about fucking up. Don't worry about, you know, trying to sound like some professional newsman or anything like that. I mean, I had vocal coaching and stuff like that because I used to be an engineer for a radio station way back when I was in college. So I feel like that may have helped me a little bit. And I'm not even using professional audio equipment. I have a laptop with a USB microphone plugged in. And by the way, this USB microphone is going to go any day now. Because it's got a long wire that plugs into the USB port. And when this microphone is not in use, I basically, I ravel it up. And I stick it in my drawer. And I think all this time of raveling it up, I'm looking at the end of the cord here where it plugs into the actual base of the mic. The wire is coming apart. And that's not good. So hopefully when this mic goes, I'll be able to buy a new one quick enough so we won't have to miss a beat here. But this is not a professional studio I'm operating in here. You know, the podcast, I have to make it sound actually less, you know, less better, for lack of a better term, than it actually is, so I, you know, can actually upload it, and it's not 50 megabytes every week, but I still think it sounds fine. It sounds like a guy plugged a microphone into his computer and took 90 minutes to do a show and tell people what he thought about professional wrestling. And I have a passion for wrestling because I've been a fan since I was a young kid. It's not always fun. They do a lot of stupid shit, but if you're a fan, you watch, you have fun, you can rant about it, you can talk about the good stuff, you can talk about the bad stuff. Some people have shows where they actually interview wrestlers. That's not the nature of this show. This show is about me. It's not about them. I come on, I give my thoughts. If you have a similar show, you and your friend, go on. Just behave the way that you would behave if you were having a conversation in the privacy of your own home. If you were sitting around shooting the shit about wrestling, do that. Make that your show. Have fun with it. That's the best advice I could give you, or anybody else listening who wants to do something on their own in the future. James writes in, is Jimmy Jacobs still with Ring of Honor? I haven't seen him on ROH since the debut on HDNet. I believe he is. I have not heard otherwise, so as far as I know, Jimmy Jacobs is still with Ring of Honor. James also finds it interesting that it was Chris Jericho who introduced the Money in the Bank concept, and years later he was cost the championship by the winner of that very match that he helped create. Well, that's true. Chris Jericho, it was his idea. He went to Vince McMahon and pitched it. That was the first Money in the Bank that he was actually involved in back at WrestleMania 21 in 2005. And he was involved in the one after that. I don't think he's been in any of them since then. But it was the brainchild of Chris Jericho. And indeed, it was Jack Swagger who took the belt from Jericho on SmackDown Friday night. So perhaps he's having some second thoughts on that. Lee wants to know my thoughts on the Divas. After seeing the Divas tag match at WrestleMania 26, it's easy to see the Divas are nothing more than a sideshow. So I ask you, Solid Monster, what would you do if you had complete control over the Divas division? Who would you get rid of? Who would you hire? And what other changes would you make? Well, one of the first things I would do is fire every single Diva, except for Maryse and Natalya. but if I couldn't do that, I would bring in Awesome Kong as quickly as possible. I know that she has already, much like Daniels, she is going to be making some dates for Ring of Honor. I don't know if she's going to be a permanent part of the ROH roster. I know that she's having her first show with them, I believe, in early May. She'll be facing Sarah Del Rey, who is another very talented female performer who, unfortunately, will likely never get a shot in WWE because she doesn't exactly have the look of a traditional diva, although I think she's very attractive. But I think Kong in WWE, if they booked her the way that she deserves to be booked, like a monster, would be huge. Now, do I have faith that they would bring her in and not try to transform her into something that she's not, make her like the modern-day version of Bertha Fay? I don't exactly have too much confidence, but Lord knows that Kong and Gail Kim helped make that TNA Knockouts division when they were both in TNA, and you've got Gail Kim, who hasn't really done a whole hell of a lot on the WWE roster. She's very talented, although she you know, it's kind of weird, because since she came back, she hasn't looked too good. You know, she hasn't looked all that motivated. She has a lot of missteps and botches in her matches, but if you bring Kong into WWE and put the two of them back together and have them reignite their feud, I think that could be I think it could help the women's division the way that the Trish Stratus Mickie James feud really bolstered that division back in 2006. Brian in upstate New York got back from an independent show called 2CW the other day, and the guest that evening was Jerry the King Lawler. His question to me is, how can Lawler wrestle while under contract with WWE? Well, Lawler has been wrestling independence for years. A lot of people don't realize that. He wrestles in Memphis, but he wrestles independence all around the country. He wants to wrestle. If it were up to him, he would wrestle all the time, more so than announce in WWE. And I'm sure these days, having to work with Michael Cole and Matt Stryker, Jerry Lawler would love to be a full-time wrestler on the WWE roster. It's just the nature of the agreement that he has with the company. It's part of his contract. Now, clearly, WWE has some degree of power over him because, you may recall, back in 2007, Hulk Hogan was a free agent, and he was going to have a big match. It would have been the biggest independent wrestling match in years. It was going to be held in Memphis. It was going to be Hulk Hogan against Jerry the King Lawler. And something like a week or so before the show, WWE put the kibosh on it and told Lawler he couldn't do it. So as a substitute, it was the Big Show, Paul White, who had already left WWE and wasn't the Big Show anymore. He fought Hogan. The match didn't do all that well. So obviously WWE could, if they really wanted to put their foot down, tell Lawler when and where he can and can't wrestle. But he has it in his contract that he can wrestle independent dates independent of the company. So there you go. This person wants to know, when do I see Shawn Michaels inevitably going into the Hall of Fame? Do I see him going in next year, perhaps, as part of WrestleMania 27? I don't, and I don't think that it would be wise for WWE to put him in until WrestleMania 28. And the reason I say that is, if I'm WWE, I want Shawn Michaels to eventually come back and wrestle another match. I don't know that Michaels is going to want to in a year. I think he'll still be in that mindset where I retired, I don't want to come back. But in 2 years, or even 3 years, he might be singing a different tune. And their chances of getting him back in kind of a package deal where he goes into the Hall of Fame and wrestles a match that same weekend. I think their chances would be much better of trying to do that for WrestleMania 28, let's say, 29, maybe WrestleMania 30. They come back to Madison Square Garden, as I hope they do. I wouldn't do it next year. The talk is that they're going to do a Hall of Fame that mostly has, it's all about the WCW stars. And Goldberg, perhaps, would be the main attraction. If Sting is no longer under contract to TNA, he would most definitely be going in. Maybe put guys like Arn Anderson in there. I think Vader, quite frankly, I haven't heard anything, but I think Big Van Vader deserves a spot if they're going to go in that direction. And Vader did wrestle for WWE. So, no, I would save Sean for at least 2 or 3 years from now and not put him in next year. And last one here for this week. Lawrence writes in from New Jersey. My condolences. He wanted to talk a little bit about TNA. He does enjoy TNA wrestling. He does have to admit, however, that the angles lately have been completely random. From week to week, it's impossible to follow, and every time someone is getting a push or gets a major win, the next week they are practically forgotten. I thought you've been harsh on TNA in the past, but honestly, I can't argue with your recent criticisms. While the shows are pretty decent on an individual basis, if you consider them in the week-to-week storyline flow, they make absolutely no sense. Aside from the obvious incompetence of Vince Russo, I think the problem goes much deeper. I think it's a case of TNA's staff trying way too hard to put on a show they think will compete instead of giving the storylines time to develop. What do you think? I think you put it better than I could. I've been harsh on TNA quite a bit. I've been harsh on WWE, maybe more so with TNA, because I think it's well-deserved. Now, I will say this in TNA's defense. Since Bischoff essentially took over the reins several weeks ago, the shows on an individual basis, they're still very inconsistent. I mean, there was a show, I think, 2 weeks ago that was just fucking atrocious. Yet, there was a show the week after that, which I thought, on its own, was good. However, wrestling is not, it's not self-contained. The whole point of a wrestling show is to build to a pay-per-view. You're building storylines so people will put down money and pay to see the payoff. And in that respect, TNA is an epic fail. I give them an F. As opposed to WrestleMania. I mean, on paper, going into the show, I'd give WWE an A. They weren't perfect, but I'd give them an A. Now, I don't think I'll be giving WWE an A for Extreme Rules, but we'll see. They've been on a roll lately. TNA never got on a roll. They don't even know what a roll is. They think you eat it. So that's the problem with TNA. I agree. The problems go much deeper. And change has to start at the top. It's all the creative vision of one guy. If you take that guy away and put somebody else in there, who knows? Maybe the next person would be worse. I would be hard-pressed to find somebody who's going to book wrestling worse than Vince Russo. He may be a really nice guy. Maybe he's a good artist. Maybe he can be your accountant. He's good with numbers. He is not good as a wrestling booker. He sucks. So if you kind of cut the head of the snake off, I mean, he's at the top of the food chain. He's writing the shows. The buck stops with him. Get rid of him, and maybe we could start to see some real change. Because if I watch Impact this Monday, for example, and I think, wow, this was a good show, and then the next week it's right back to the same old stupid shit, what was the point? So I agree. I think you put it very, very well. And this is coming from a TNA fan, mind you. An admitted TNA fan agrees with me. Shows you there's something wrong there. There's nothing wrong, however, with you sending me email. It's always a good thing. TheSolomonster@gmail.com. TheSolomonster@gmail.com. All one word. When you write in, I've seen more people doing this. It'd be kind of cool if everybody could just put at the top of the email, you know, listener since episode whatever, just to give me a sense of how long you've been listening, if you're an old, you know, an old school listener, if you're a new listener, just out of curiosity. So you might want to put that in there. Follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/Solomonster. That's always a fun time. You can download the show, of course, subscribe through the iTunes music store. It is free. Don't be put off by the word store. You might have seen, by the way, I posted a photo on my Twitter. I was in the mall yesterday doing some last-minute preparation for a trip I'm going on. I'm going to talk about that in a second. And I'm walking by, and I see the Apple store. And completely forgot that yesterday was the official launch day for the new iPad. I quickly realized this when I walked by the store and saw it filled with people. I mean, you couldn't see anything except just a mass of bodies. Now, a normal person would think, I'm not going anywhere near that store. But, of course, I'm no normal person. I have to gravitate towards the store. I have to see what this iPad looks like that's so fantastic. So they only have a certain number of them up front. Of course, everybody is using them. I stand behind this one guy. He finishes up, and now I step up to the plate here, and I pick up the iPad. I'm looking at it, and I will say this much. It looks really cool. It's just a cool-looking device. I don't own any touchscreen devices myself. Even the cell phone I use, it's not touchscreen. I like having a hard keyboard and all that. But, you know, being able to flip pages by just tapping the screen and, you know, tapping this and hitting that, to me, this is all foreign. Very cool, though. And, you know, as a device, almost like a toy to use, it's exceptional. And then I see the price tag, and I think they start at $500, and they're as much as $800 for the more advanced versions that have, I guess, more storage space on them. Because essentially, you know, people will buy these things, at least some people will buy these things, as a replacement for their laptop, let's say. It's basically like a mini computer. It doesn't do everything that a laptop does. For example, the first iteration of the iPad doesn't have flash support, which I know bothers a lot of people. But on its own, it's a cool-looking device. Not worth $500 in my opinion, but it's a cool-looking device. So, of course, one of the first things I do when I get on there, I want to see what SE Scoops looks like. Bring up the website. SE Scoops looks fine. I go to the iTunes store. Type in Solomonster Sounds Off in the search field, and sure enough, comes right up. Go to the page. See all the ratings for the show. Listing of all the episodes for if you want to download them. And then I say, you know, let me check on some news here. Been out of the house for a while. Wanted an update on the story about Canyon. I had read that Canyon had passed away that, you know, I had read about it that morning. So I bring up a wrestling website, and I'm reading up on Canyon, and I notice that the guy standing next to me on the iPad next to me kind of is peeking over at what I've got going on my screen. Then he turns away. I didn't pay any attention to it until about a minute later. I look over on his iPad, and he's on YouTube viewing all of the promotional videos, you know, those awesome Shawn Michaels Undertaker videos and all that from WrestleMania 26. And I don't know, this just amused me for some example. He's watching that, and then, you know, when you're watching the video on YouTube, you kind of, you look at the suggested links on the right-hand side, and before you know it, you're watching all different kinds of videos, and he's watching old Austin versus McMahon clips, and he's just, you know, The music is playing, the audio is playing, half the store is like, what the hell is that? You know, it was the segment where Austin made Vince pee his pants. I'm like, I gotta get out of here. This is out of control. So, if anybody's thinking about buying an iPad, you know, my review on it, really cool. I just could not bring myself to spend $500 or $600 on it. Especially since I just bought a new laptop. What the hell am I gonna buy an iPad for? But, if you got the money for it, you know, it's a cool device to have. So I guess, you know, why not pick one up? But I couldn't do it. So anyway, I'm in the store yesterday because I'm buying some items for a trip I'm going on. I think I've mentioned before, I'm going to Costa Rica for a week. My first trip to South America with a couple of buddies. I'll be down there until next Wednesday or Thursday. I don't even know. I think I'm coming back next Wednesday night, something like that. I should be back for the following weekend to do a show. There will be no new podcast next weekend. Episode 107 will have to wait. So what I think I'm going to do is, just to kind of hold you guys over while I'm gone, this Wednesday or Thursday, since I'm leaving on Thursday, maybe before I leave on Thursday, I will, in iTunes, I will upload a vintage episode of The Sound Off. Won't tell you which one, but I will upload an old episode. It'll be somewhere between episode 1 and episode 50, since I think those are the episodes that less of you are more likely to still have saved or have listened to in the past. So I'll probably pick one out, and we'll upload it. So while I'm gone, you'll have something to listen to. You'll have some Solomonster in your life while I'm gone. I won't have any phone service or anything, so I don't think I'll be able to post on Twitter or do anything pretty much while I'm gone. So I will likely be back the following weekend with a new show at that point. So, yeah, that's the way we're going to work it. I'll probably put that vintage episode up, like I said, Wednesday or Thursday. Look for it then. And hopefully we'll be back the following weekend with a fresh new episode. And hopefully I'll have some good tales to tell and nothing bad will happen to me. I hear good things about Costa Rica. I know the roads down there for some of the places that we're going, because we're driving all over, are not that great. And I only found out yesterday, apparently, that, and I know some of you listening are in foreign countries, and this may be the common standard there, but here in America, everything's automatic transmission. I mean, I know a couple of people who know how to drive manual, you know, who know how to drive stick. It's not commonplace here. I had a friend who tried to learn, took a seminar, and he just failed miserably. It's just not the standard here. And apparently my cheap-ass friend decided that we're going to have to get a manual transmission car because it's a lot cheaper that way. And so our phone conversation the other day consisted of me asking him, well, I assume you do know how to drive stick. And after 10 seconds of silence, his answer was, well, we'll see. So hopefully, if I survive and make it back in time, there will be another show the following weekend. So, in any event, that's going to do it. Episode 106, big show, a lot going on. WrestleMania in the books. Don't forget, Impact starts at 8 p.m. tomorrow night. I may actually have to miss Impact and part of or all of Raw. I may have to be making a trip over to the hospital. My uncle's in the hospital, recovering from a pretty serious operation. I haven't been able to see him over the last week. I may shoot on over there after work tomorrow, and when I get home, I have no idea, but we'll see. Should be an interesting week of TV, and then I'll be out of the loop for a week, so hopefully when I come back, you know, things haven't fallen apart. Raw's still good. Impact has improved, right? Person can hope. Person can dream. Until next time, be well. Stay safe, as I will try to. Watch for the vintage episode of The Sound Off, and we'll be back with episode 107 right here next weekend on SEScoops.com. Take care, guys.